continue in this tradition of host-environment interactions, and where we frame environment as more social systems as well as the human values that are embedded in it. And our next speaker is Dr. Robert Lariton from Toronto. Robert is a professor of psychiatry. He is also a senior scientist and section head of the Mood and Anxiety Program there. His expertise in particular is integration of clinical research in adults with atypical depression with a developmental research focus, and I believe this is an important perspective to integrate science and society type of research. And the title of his presentation is A Lifespan Perspective Based on Dopamine Gene Variation. Robert, thank you for coming here to Montreal.
Thank you very much. So just to introduce myself, I am a psychiatrist, and I deal mostly with mood disorders. But what you will learn quickly if you work with mood disorders is that a very large number of patients with mood disorders have problems with overeating and obesity. And this creates a very interesting way of understanding how the brain might play a role in obesity, although I don't think it can help us understand all of obesity, but rather one particular component of obesity. Okay. So the major thesis that drives the work that I'm interested in is that a major cause of the obesity epidemic is, on the one hand, greater societal stress, which actually we know does exist relative to about 30 or 40 years ago, and more anxiety and negative emotions as a result of this stress. And then the use of comfort food to alleviate these negative emotions. So very much using food as a drug to help us feel better on a day-to-day basis. And combining that vulnerability with the fact that we have this very powerful food around us all the time, and it is so readily available, creates a very powerful mix that I think is a very important contributor to at least a significant number of cases of obesity out there. Now, one of the constructs that really drives this link between mood and eating is the construct of emotional eating that many of you or most of you are probably familiar with. This is largely the work of Tatiana Van Strien and her colleagues who have looked at various types of eating behavior. And really what emotional eating is the tendency to eat in response to emotions rather than hunger. And the main emotions that tend to drive overeating in this way are depression, boredom, and anxiety. Very common emotions, of course, that are experienced every day. This is very much tied to the notion of comfort food, as you can imagine, and as I mentioned, is very important in terms of models of eating that relate to addictive behaviors. This is a slide just showing some data from work I'm doing with Carolyn Davis in Toronto, showing that as a group, obese people will report significantly higher levels of emotional eating than will controls. That's the blue versus the white comparison. And the extreme group that shows the highest levels of emotional eating are patients with binge eating disorder. And there's a whole continuum across that spectrum. So there are many individuals who may not have full syndrome binge eating disorder, but high levels of binging that would fall somewhere in between. So emotional eating is an important concept both for generalized obesity and most importantly for obesity that's driven by actual binge eating behavior. Now, as I mentioned, I work with mostly depressed individuals, and there are several subtypes in the DSM of depression that involve overeating, and in particular, emotional eating as part of the core phenotype. Atypical depression, in fact, is defined by overeating as well as oversleeping and social sensitivity. I'm very interested in seasonal depression, which occurs in the wintertime, which also involves high levels of emotional eating. I mentioned binge eating disorder, and bulimia nervosa is a little bit different. It's an eating disorder whereby there's not only, of course, the problem of overeating, but also tremendous cognitive issues related to weight gain and body image, as well as behaviors to eliminate weight gain. So the basic research strategy I've been interested in is to understand emotional eating in terms of both genes and environment, And in particular, the genes I'm interested in are dopamine system genes for various reasons. The environmental component I'm most interested in addition to the general environment, is the more specific environment related to attachment behavior, maternal sensitivity and attachment. I won't have time today to go into that, but it is very important for the developmental work that I'll be alluding to at the end. So let's talk a little bit about dopamine and dopamine genes and how dopamine genes might relate to emotional eating. This is a cartoon of the brain's reward pathway that you'll probably hear quite a bit about this morning. And this pathway is thought to mediate not only natural rewards of various types, including eating behavior, but also mediates various addictive behaviors. And Alain, who will be talking after me, has done a lot of work looking at the similarities and differences between these types of addictive behaviors. One of the genes that plays a role in the brain's reward pathway is the dopamine 4 receptor gene. And this is a gene that has great interest for the phenotypes that I'm interested in for a variety of reasons. It's expressed in the brain's reward pathway. It's also highly variable, which is what you want when you're doing a genetic study. And very, very important is that it has a functional variant, a very strongly functional variant called the 7-repeat allele, which is associated with very low functionality. So this is equivalent to a low dopamine sensitivity gene. The other thing about it that's so interesting in terms of obesity is that there's strong evidence from geneticists that this has been, the 7-repeat in particular, has been positively selected for in human evolution over the past 40,000 years. So it lends itself very nicely to evolutionary models of obesity, and one wonders whether the 7-repeat might have thrifty qualities, if you will, and be one of those genes that has, in some ways, protected us over the course of our recent evolution. This is a cartoon of the receptor, and you can see at the bottom, do you have a pointer here? I can just show you quickly, but if you have the 4-repeat that's down here, that's the normal status of the receptor. It's sort of tightly wound, if you will, and when dopamine hits, you get a sort of normal signal. If you get this really lax and loose 7-repeat allele, the whole system is underactive. You can almost visualize that, although it might be a little bit idealized, but that is the functionality and what the different repeats do at a functional level. So the basic research question I've been starting with over the years is to see whether the 7-repeat is associated with overeating and mood problems in those atypically depressed patients that I described before. And we started with seasonal affective disorder. And the first publication, in fact, was in that group. And what we found was that carriers of the 7-repeat, these were all females, by the way, who had seasonal depression, the carriers had much higher maximum lifetime BMIs than did the non-carriers of this low dopamine genetic variant. And we talked about a whole evolutionary model that you can read about if you're interested in that related to the 7-repeat and seasonal weight conservation, et cetera, et cetera. Of most interest was a follow-up paper where we showed that the increase in weight was due to eating behavior. So the 7-repeat carriers, this is the same group of individuals, had much higher levels of binge eating, about 40% compared to less than 20% for those who didn't have the allele. So this means that that weight gain that we reported was due to actual eating. This was also very, very important as it relates to the mood component. So we also showed that the 7-repeat carriers had experienced high levels of childhood depression, or at least they were reporting high levels of childhood depression relative to the non-carriers, suggesting a developmental pathway starting with mood problems and then probably leading to overeating as a compensation for that over time. So I think a really nice model, actually, of the development of emotional eating, perhaps. We also did this in bulimia nervosa and found the same general effect, the carriers having the high BMI. And in binge eating disorder, this is ongoing work, again, with Carolyn Davis. It's a small sample right now, but the effect is in the same direction. So that's now two replications in two different or three different groups now with overeating and mood problems. Now, as I alluded to before, some of the work that I started to do in adults related to childhood vulnerability And over the years, I've become more and more interested in going back to the early origins of eating behavior to really understand how this all unfolds. One of the problems with working with complex adults is that it's very hard to know cause and effect. So much of my recent research has now focused on childhood developmental work, and the main cohort that I'm involved with and the main collaborators I'm involved with are a part of the so-called MAVEN project. That's Maternal Adversity, Vulnerability, and Neurodevelopment. This started off as a CIHR team grant headed by Michael Meany here at McGill and Stephen Matthews at U of Toronto, as well as Meyer Steiner at McMaster. And basically, MAVEN is a multi-site, multidisciplinary study of child development with a focus on neurodevelopment, with PIs covering all kinds of different specialties, very consistent with the models that were described before. And it involves systematic longitudinal follow-up of children with age-appropriate measures, where possible with animal models in parallel, and with a priority on intergenerational processes, and very much an integrative, collaborative approach. And this is some initial data from MAVEN that relates to the DRD4 gene. And what this is data from a 48-month snack test. So these are kids that are 4 years old, and they come to the laboratory, and they're allowed to basically eat a meal that is pre-measured with all kinds of different foods. And we basically measure what they eat and then analyze it in terms of the effects we're interested in. And what you can see here are four basically graphs. This is total calories, and you have fat intake, carbohydrates, and proteins during the snack test. And what you have is boys and girls separately, and 7R negative, 7R positive refers to that gene that I've been alluding to in the adults. And what's so interesting in our initial analysis, this is preliminary, but quite interesting, is that there are differences in boys and girls, and the one group that stands out is eating a lot. Are, in fact, girls who have the 7 repeat allele, the same variant that seems to be predicting binge eating and weight gain in the adult depressed populations. Now, these are normal kids. They do come from high-risk families, though. So the mothers of these kids do have higher rates of depression than average, and they come from a lower socioeconomic status than the average kids. And that might contribute to this. But we have to be cautious. We don't know if this is abnormal or just a normal sort of pattern. What's more interesting is when you look at the macronutrient intake, because a lot of the action seems to be with fat intake. The boys who have the 7 repeat allele actually have lower fat intake than boys who don't. And this is a significant gender by gene interaction, whereas the girls with the 7 repeat allele are eating more fat than than their peers who don't carry the high-risk allele. Now, the boys are interesting in terms of carbohydrate intake because they show an increase in carbohydrate intake if they have the 7-repeat allele. So one explanation for that is that the 7-repeat allele is doing something slightly different in the two genders, where in boys it's leading to carbohydrate intake, in girls it's promoting fat intake. Protein intake was also significant, and in this case, for some reason, the protein intake in boys who carry the 7-repeat is very, very low. I'm not sure exactly what that means. It might relate to the fact that you can only eat so much, and they are eating other sorts of macronutrients, and that might be why they have the low protein intake. So preliminary data, but very, very interesting in terms of the direction, and the fact that these are somewhat high-risk kids suggest that they may go on to develop various forms of disordered eating over time. So we'll be keeping an eye on that over time. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just wrap up there and see if people have any questions. These are just acknowledgments for both the clinical work in adults and the main collaborators for the MAVEN work that I discussed before. Good.
Thank you, Robert, for the very interesting work. So we have time for about 2 to 4 questions. Again, please introduce yourself, Laurette.
Yes, can you put back your slide 24?
Sure. All right. There we go.
Is there any reason the differentiated for the boys in particular, the differentiated pattern between fat, carbohydrate, and protein? Is there any evolutionary nutritional arguments that can be made there? Have you?
We thought about that, you know, because of the whole evolution issue with the 7-repeated allele. I mean, it might be that in males, something about long-term energy storage is important. I would have thought that protein intake would be higher. I would think that the most evolutionary thing to do would be to eat a lot of protein if you're, a growing male. In terms of fat, I think it might relate to puberty and the anticipation of puberty and, in that sense, promote reproduction. I think a lot of people would argue that. But in males, it's hard to know why carbohydrates might be seen as an adaptive process. I'd be very interested in feedback and any ideas that people might have about carbohydrates in particular. Keep in mind, these are 48-month-old kids, so it's a hard group to think about. We don't understand that much about normal eating at that age, so it's rather tricky.
Thanks, Robert. Another question from the back?
Bill Comer, University of Alberta. Very nice talk, Robert. Two things, really. One is that I think the carbohydrates might be, there's a question of reward as well, that there's that Russian blood sugar that might be more desirable in the boys carrying the 7R allele. But the other question I have for you is there any evidence that what you've got is a population of obese adults that have the 7R allele. Is it only the overeating that leads to the obesity, or does the signaling of the 7R D4 receptor change in the presence of, let's say, relatively high levels of triglycerides? Does anybody know?
That's a good question. I'm not aware of any studies that have looked at the metabolic side of things. I think that's an important thing to do going forward. And there's lots of ways that metabolic hormones can interact with dopamine and dopamine genes. There's just no data at this point to look at that. We will be able to look at that as the kids get older. So one of the things that we are going to be doing, of course, is looking at development of obesity. And once they hit about 8 or 9 years old, to get some blood measures and look at triglycerides, other measures as well at a more metabolic level. So we'll be able to answer that in a few years.
What social situations would the 7 allele be triggered?
Excellent question.
I mean, think about epigenetics particularly, but if you're talking about brain in society and society and brain pathways and interactions, we know that it takes more than actually having an allele or some aberration that produces phenotype in a behavior. So I'm more interested in your complementary part, which you didn't get to.
Okay, so the question relates to what about the environmental component of it and the whole epigenetic aspect of it. One thing I'd like to say about that is that there are many people who look at the 7-repeat allele as a plasticity gene variant. And what that means is that it makes you more prone or more influenced by your environment in both directions. So it's not a matter of good or bad. It's a matter of being more sensitive to your environment. And I actually think that's a great model. And what that means is that if you grow up in an enriched environment, you can actually have better than average outcomes. And if you grow up in an adverse environment, you have worse than average outcomes. One of the interesting things about the 7-repeat as it relates to body weight is that there are a couple of studies that have been done in normal general populations that haven't shown a strong effect of the 7-repeat allele. And what that might reflect is the need to have an adverse environment to bring out the vulnerability. It sort of goes along with that notion of plasticity. So I think what we're picking up here probably does relate to adverse environments, because the MAVEN cohort, for example, is an adverse cohort, and certainly the clinical populations I deal with have very, very high rates of adversity of various types. So I actually think that these 7-repeat findings may turn out to be limited to individuals who've been exposed to adverse environments in that way. But we'll have to see. We'll have to look at them. We'll have to look at the other side of the coin, the enriched environments more. So that's the answer I would have, is that the environmental issue might be one of just being more sensitive in general, and then happening to have adversity at more of a familial level. The particular construct that I'm interested in that I mentioned is attachment. And there's a whole literature on attachment in the seven repeat allele that I can discuss afterwards. But there's lots of reasons to believe that the seven repeat actually mediates many important aspects of attachment. Attachment has elements of reward sensitivity. It's very, very important, actually, to attachment. So that's a very... It creates a very interesting model where the environment is itself shaped by the gene through effects on reward sensitivity, if you will.
Thanks, Robert. I think this is a very important comment and question that was asked, because part of the aim of this kind of research is to identify the specific social architecture, if you will, that interacts with the host, because many of these social systems are also potential targets for intervention. So that's important to keep in mind. We're not only studying society and social systems in terms of the ways they interact with biology, but they are also actionable sort of targets, potentially. And I wondered, I don't know, Robert, if this makes sense, you're the expert in this. We always talk about endophenotypes. I wonder if we need sort of a counterpart of that in the context of society, whether we need some kind of societal architecture analysis that specifically interacts with certain endophenotypes, because we always think about the host side, but there's also the social systems and their fine architecture, if you like. I have two minor comments, and then we have time for another question, I believe, from the back, or a couple more. Because of the interaction between dopamine and serotonin systems,
yeah.
I wonder if your clients have studied them and probably you do with larger sample sizes. The second sort of comment is the sort of looking at time series analysis that may be able to parse out these kind of fine-grained signals in a better way. And perhaps you already have planned that in larger samples.
Yeah, so just to address the second question, which relates to the longitudinal aspect, that's very much my main interest, is the whole longitudinal aspect, to try to understand the adults that I see, actually, by going virtually back to day one and following kids going forward to see how they develop. And we'll certainly with the MAVEN cohort, we'll very much be able to do that and test the longitudinal aspect of things. And the hypothesis is that things are going to start with more mood-related problems and more executive function-related problems, and the actual binge eating or overeating will appear somewhat later, you know, as the kids go into teenagehood. So that's one major set of analyses that we're going to do. Sorry, what's the other question?
It was serotonin.
Okay. So interestingly enough, my research started with serotonin, and I switched to dopamine specifically because serotonin seems to explain satiety better, but dopamine is much better, I think, at explaining reward. And as it relates to emotional eating, it seems to me that dopamine is more likely to be a mediator of that. I haven't looked at interactions of dopamine with serotonin. What I have looked at is BDNF. BDNF is brain-derived neurotrophic factor, and it is a peptide that's very important in terms of how dopamine and serotonin neurons develop in the brain. So if you don't have enough BDNF active, especially early in development, your dopamine system and your serotonin system is likely to be underdeveloped, so to speak. And we've actually reported a couple of publications with BDNF interactions with the D4 allele. So I think that's sort of interesting. And that might relate to the adversity piece. So you might have adversity affecting BDNF, then the low BDNF leads to low dopamine, and there you go. So,
if you have a burning question, we can take one more question. From the back.
Just a
quick question. Do you know, Anad mentioned that there's an idea that the 7R allele is also associated with higher mobility. That is, under adverse circumstances, you leave because you can't get your fix of whatever it is until you find it, which makes a perfectly good sense and is adaptive, which might explain some of the evolutionary pressure. But the question I had is, do these kids come from more mobile family than ones that are D7R carriers?
Well, okay, that's a great question. There's a whole literature on the notion of the 7 repeat being adaptive in migrating populations, so populations that have made major migrations over time. And there's all kinds of interesting evidence in that regard. We haven't looked at mobility. I'm not sure how I would do that. I mean, do you have an idea of how you would do that within a Canadian cohort or within a Canadian population? Do you mean ancestrally, or do you mean literally?
Yeah, the parents, and then do you have the do you have their genetics as well, the mother?
We do in the MAVEN. We don't in the adult studies, unfortunately.
But I mean,
in the MAVEN, we do.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, to some extent, we could probably look at, you know, a history and try to get into, you know, several generations in terms of how, where people come from. Do they come from Europe? Do they, you know, if they migrated over time?
They come from Newfoundland.
Yeah, okay.
We have to move on to the next brief comment.
Yeah, just a brief comment. As the day unfolds, we'll be talking about this concept that we have started articulating of environment responsiveness and those phenotypes. And I think that the point of developing this precise portrait of the environment is there. But also, the brain is a very important. When you look at gene and environment, we forget the brain in this. And as we look at the relationship between the presence of an allele and its instantiation, I think much of understanding more of the brain is a key aspect. So that's my big comment.
Thank you, Robert.
Okay, thank you.